First, a broad discussion of the issue of unsafe skies today with the downing of the Malaysian jet MH17 over Ukraine by a sophisticated surface-to-air radar-guided missile last week and the restrictions of airspace around Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport in the midst of Israel's battles in the Gaza Strip with Hamas. Precautionary flight restrictions are in place in both zones today. In the realm of civil aviation, airlines take recommendations about risky airspace. They are also notified about closed security zones that, if violated, may provoke responses from governments or hostile forces on the ground. That's the general lay of the land, or the skies, as the case may be. One thing is true, there are a lot of civilian aircraft and lots of anti-aircraft weapons in the world right now. Can they coexist? Two terrific voices now, Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, instrument-rated pilot, and the author of China Airborne. Hey, Jim.
Hello, John. Nice to talk to you.
Also with us, Stephen Biddle, professor of political science at George Washington University and an adjunct senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He also worked on counterinsurgency for General David Petraeus and General Stanley McChrystal. Professor Biddle, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with you, Professor Biddle. How do we understand what capabilities are there on the ground? And we'll get to the issue of how safe civilian passengers should feel flying anywhere in the world today. Let's take Ukraine as an example. We know there's some sort of surface-to-air missile capability in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, the separatists apparently have quite a bit of military hardware. We don't know exactly what they've got, but the State Department has reported that they have at least five T-64 tanks, at least four BMP-2 infantry fighting vehicles, a variety of other armored ground equipment, manned portable air defense systems, the kind of shoulder-fired missiles that seek infrared signals that people talk about a lot, and at least apparently some radar-guided, higher-altitude-capable surface-to-air missiles like the SA-11. Now, they've got a lot of this gear. Having the gear and using it, though, are two very different matters.
And the SA-11 has a range of 70,000 feet, which, of course, is clearly relevant in the MH-17 case. The man-portable missiles, the infrared, as you've talked about them, heat-seeking missiles, they're much lower altitude, right?
That's right. And they also are after very different kinds of targeting information. The kind of shoulder-fired heat-seeking missiles that we know the separatists have and lots of guerrilla organizations have around the world can be fired pretty effectively by a single individual or a small team with very limited contextual information about the situation. They can see the airplane they're firing at. If it's a civilian airliner, they're likely to know it. Radar-guided missiles targeting much higher altitude aircraft or firing at much greater distances are operating with much more abstract information about what it is that they're shooting at. The crews are looking at some combination of very abstract incoming radar information, other data coming to them through a larger communications network that's supposed to establish the context. They can't actually look at the thing, see what it is, recognize what they're shooting at, and making a decision based on kind of classic visual information. It's a much more abstract problem for the crew of a radar-operated missile.
Professor Biddle, that is a very sophisticated way of saying they're shooting at little blobs on a screen, right?
They're shooting at what they can see as a little blob and what other people in a communications network are telling them is or isn't blob type A as opposed to blob type B.
Interesting. On the issue of Gaza and Ben-Gurion Airport in Israel's airspace, is the capability there mostly a threat on takeoff and landing, or are there higher altitude threats as well coming from Gaza and other areas around the West Bank?
Well, I mean, there's a lot we don't know. My guess is that what airlines are worried about primarily is that rockets may hit the apron or the runway. And so aircraft that are taxiing or in the process of taking off or landing might get hit by the kinds of rockets that are being fired at Israeli cities. They also, of course, might be hit by these kinds of short-range, shoulder-fired, heat-seeking missiles. I have not seen any information suggesting that Hamas has the kind of radar-guided, high-altitude anti-aircraft capability that the Ukrainian separatists have.
Stephen Biddle is professor of political science at George Washington University. Also with us is Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, a veteran instrument-rated pilot and author of China Airborne. So, Jim Fallows, as I'm strapping myself into my seat for my, trip overseas, Should I be worried about the proliferation of anti-aircraft capability around the world? My pilot isn't necessarily going to know what's below him or her.
In certain areas, of course, this is manifestly a challenge, as we've seen in the past week. The big picture also, of course, is that generally commercial airlines, especially in the first world and in China, are among the safest things you can do with your time. We've had these two horrific episodes, both involving, by coincidence, Malaysia airplanes in the last year, the one that disappeared in the Indian Ocean and this one that was shot down. But generally, over the years, there have been fewer and fewer risks of any kind in commercial airlines. So I think it's a matter of how exactly the airlines are going to work with the international authorities, mainly in the form of what's called ICAO, and their national authorities, the FAA in the United States, Eurocontrol in Europe, about what is agreed on as being an acceptably safe area for airlines to continue their normal travel over and what has crossed the threshold into being dangerous, which is the issue with Ben Gurion right now.
What is, is it possible that we are crossing a turning point? If we look back in history, a lot of incidents in the 80s, there was KAL-007, where a South Korean airliner apparently deliberately challenged airspace in Soviet Russia, or didn't. In any case, it was a confrontation into controlled airspace. There was the shooting down of the Iranian airliner over the Persian Gulf by a U.S. Navy warship in the midst of a conflict zone there. There have been other shootdowns of planes. Of course, the Lockerbie was a terrorist incident. Can you go back in history and give us any precedent for what's going on today? And are the rules possibly changing, Jim Fallows?
I think the rules possibly are changing. And you mentioned the two main precedents, the Korean Air episode over the Soviet Union and the Iranian one shut down by the Vincennes. And I think it's worth recognizing why, to people in the aviation world, things look really different today from the way they did a week ago. A week ago, it was known that there was all this activity in Ukraine. The FAA and some other authorities had simply forbidden flight over the Crimea, and they discouraged it over certain parts of Ukraine, not so much for anti-aircraft problems as because of airspace management disputes between Russia and the Ukrainian authorities, which left them unclear, other countries unclear about who was going to be in control of the planes. But the idea of deliberately using military-scale anti-aircraft missiles capable of going into what we call the flight altitudes, that is essentially 30,000 feet and above, that really is a new concept as a threat. The idea of being vulnerable on takeoff and landing, as you've discussed, or having some of the sort of runway damage, as Professor Biddle was saying in Israel, those were known. The being shot down deliberately by an anti-aircraft high-altitude missile, that was not really contemplated as an active threat even a week ago. And so I think airlines are now saying, how big of a new phenomenon is this and what do we have to adjust?
Let's talk a little bit about what discretion pilots have, Jim Fallows. You know this up and down. If I'm a pilot and I get up and reading the morning paper over my coffee, see an issue in a country below a flight path that I'm going to travel over, and I notice that there is a international caution over that zone, do I have the discretion as a pilot to say, you know what, I'm just going to veer out of the way here and go out of this zone entirely, even if there's not an actual ban on the airspace? Or is it up to some sort of international regulators?
It's a combination of those things. In the middle of flight, pilots have absolute authority to do anything they think to see and be in the safety of the airplane. They can deviate around a storm. Usually they tell the controllers they're doing that, but finally a pilot is assumed to have command authority to make those sorts of decisions. If you're talking about large reroutings to avoid whole airspaces, that's usually a matter that what airlines usually rely on is the governmental authorities, both national and international, to say this is safe, that is not safe. And the presumption here is that the intelligence systems that are required to make those judgments are not something every airline can manage on its own. The international and national bodies are presumably on top of that. Generally, they rely on that. There's a sort of a secondary tier where airlines can, on specific flight plans, they can request various routings. They can say, we'd like to go this way because of weather or because of X, Y, or Z. So that's why some airlines did decide to avoid Ukraine, even while most others were still flying through it. The pilot is in a difficult, unless he wants to declare an emergency in flight, it's hard for him or her just in the middle of the trip to say, well, I think I'm going to give Israel a wide berth on this time.
Great information. Jim Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic, instrument-rated pilot, and author of China Airborne. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, John.
Final thought, Professor Biddle. Are airports increasingly a target in this era, and do you see a pattern here?
Well, aviation authorities have been worried for decades now, actually, about rebels or guerrillas or terrorists or insurgents who can locate themselves just outside the secure perimeter of the airport and use these kinds of short-range infrared shoulder-fired missiles to take down aircraft on landing and takeoff. A lot of the fear, for example, when the Qaddafi government fell in Libya, was that these kinds of missiles would end up on the black market going who knows where. And there have been known attempts by terrorists to shoot down airliners from these kinds of locations just off the end of the runway, mostly unsuccessful, but that's a matter of luck and happenstance and could very well change. The trouble is that many airports, for example, are located near urban areas, and it's difficult to be able to control built-up potential firing locations near runways.
It's a scary...
So this problem has been around for a while.
Indeed. Stephen Biddle, professor of political science at George Washington University, adjunct senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.